Hi, this is Daniel Garb of the Movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. It's the near future in a major city. Celeste is a graduate of the Space Academy studying rockets since she was a little girl. Her mother was a famous astronaut who disappeared on a space mission, so she's raised by a robot who serves as her best friend and her parental unit. Now it's her turn. She's heading out on a 6-month trip into the far reaches of the galaxy and beyond. Can Celeste travel to new planets collecting samples for scientific research and return safely to her home? And will her beloved robot still be waiting for this space cadet? Space Cadet is a new animated film entirely without spoken dialogue. It's a funny, poignant, and bittersweet look at our futures. It's work of Montreal-based composer, musician, graphic novelist, scratch DJ, and director-producer Kid Koala, a.k.a. Eric San. His music has appeared on everything from NFB films to Sesame Street movies like Scott Pilgrim and Baby Driver and even Nintendo games. Space Cadet played at TIFF and Berlin to great acclaim and will be screening at Toronto's Real Asian Film Festival on November 5th. I last spoke with Kid Koala on this show in 2014. I'm very pleased to have him back again via Zoom to tell us more about Space Cadet. Hi, Eric. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Okay, so Celeste is a young astronaut making her first solo space voyage. What is this trip for? What's the purpose of her trip?
So Celeste has just graduated from the Space Academy and she's sent off on her first mission, and it is to try to discover and collect plant life specimens from extraterrestrial planets in the outer reaches of the galaxy.
And while she's there, she in space and the robot down the ground have flashbacks of their past together. Why do you tell the story in that way, as opposed to chronologically?
For me, the film kind of celebrates these memories, these sometimes seemingly insignificant interactions from one's childhood that might be very character building or perspective changing or paradigm shifting for a young child. I know in my own experience, it would have been maybe a 1 or 2 minute interaction where my father first taught me how to draw a boat, or my mother taught me how to fold something out of a strip of paper and make a geometric shape. These things, like when I brought them up to my parents as an adult, saying, "Do you remember that time we were at a restaurant and you drew this boat and you took the time to explain to me what all the different parts of the boat were?" And they don't have any recollection. They were probably just trying to keep me calm or occupied and not acting up in a restaurant or whatnot. But in sometimes those moments, at least from a child's perspective, I remember just feeling like the whole universe kind of expanded. You know, my father could, I didn't know this about my father, he's a scientist. He's, you know, was a cancer researcher when I was a kid, and then he went into genetic toxicology when I was in high school. But I always knew him as kind of a egghead scientist guy. But when he drew a bus, I didn't know A, that my father could draw, and B, that somebody I knew could draw that well. And as a child, it was one of those moments where I said, wow, maybe I could learn to draw, you know, maybe, what does this mean? You know, I thought drawings were just for, you know, people who studied that or just naturally gifted. And I think that's what it is to me. It was like sometimes remembering those moments are just really short kind of vignettes, even in my own real life memory, you know. And so this film really tries to celebrate those times in your life. I think there's a handful for most people that they can remember, you know.
You seem to have incorporated just what you're talking about just now, the importance of origami, like paper folding, and art within the story of the film.
Yeah, yeah. Both my parents, they're not technically artists. My mother was an accountant. My father, like I said, was a scientist. But they were creative, you know, and I think, you know, I remember once I was a kid and I saw this palm tree. It was kind of a fabric, just 80s palm tree that was made just as a sort of a room decoration. I said, "Oh, that tree's cool. How much is it?" You know, my mother, who's an accountant, looked at it and said, "Oh, my, it was several hundred dollars or something." And she's like, "We could make that." And I said, "What?" And then so the next part of the afternoon ended up us going to the fabric store and her, you know, she said, "But you can make it any way you want, like with your own colors and your own whatever, you know." And so she actually showed me kind of this DIY ethos of like, oh, you know, you could learn how to make something like that, and then you can also twist your own personality into it with your own color scheme and your own like style of leaves or whatever you want. And so that's from an accountant mom who was just being creative and not wanting to spend several hundred dollars on a, you know, room decoration for her kid. Yeah. But I learned, you know, I continue to apply that attitude towards most things.
Well, let's talk about color, because your earlier stuff and your graphic novels were very much black and white. I'm thinking of Nophonia, yes. Must Fall. Here you're in a film form and it's suddenly you have like any color you want to use. What was that like expanding into a color-filled world?
Well, to me, it was quite daunting. So we actually did some early tests with Toronto's own Lillian Chan, who's our production designer, and Corinne Merrill, who's our art director. We did some early tests using the kind of scratch board technique that I used in the first graphic novel, but while we were watching it, it was just kind of jumping around a bit too much, too buzzy, you know, and kind of fatiguing to watch. So I said, okay, well, let's try a different technique, you know. And we went to do some tests in CG animation, and I take no credit for the color palette. It's completely Lillian and Corinne, who are just absolute ninjas of color and color theory. And I think what they wanted to create was sort of a handcrafted look, even paper texture, which is reminiscent of like our Nuphonia shows and our Storyville Mosquito shows, how some of the sets were built. But they did it in the digital realm, you know, kind of purposefully simplifying and kind of flattening some of the design. And I think that really harked back to when Lillian was looking at some of the original panels that I'd drawn in the graphic novel. Like this composition right here, there wouldn't be too much stuff in the background to get lost in. It was really more about focusing on the moment and what the character was doing. So we tried to apply that to the design of the shots in the film also.
So let's talk about the music. Now, most movies, they shoot a movie, they edit it, they put it all together, and they bring in the composer to write a score and conduct a score that matches the feel of the movie. But you wrote a score to this 10 years ago or 12 years ago, right? Long before the movie was even made.
Yeah, well, the original graphic novel had a 15-track sort of companion CD to it. Just certain pages and certain scenes I had kind of dreamt up what the musical cue might have been.
Did it translate into the final film itself at all? Or
a lot of those tracks do end up in the film, or expanded variations of those tracks did. However, I was still under about 45 minutes worth of music. So Mylène Chalet, who's our screenwriter, had adapted the story from my graphic novel to this feature length. She had this brilliant idea of kind of having at the heart of each sort of chapter, if you will, a song, a kind of throwback song, maybe from the, you know, the classic songbook of yesteryear's sort of jazz standards and whatnot. She would kind of thematically based around that, knowing that there'd be no dialogue in the film. So I also got a chance to sort of make my own soundtrack mixtape in a way with a combination of these songs, which were selected things like, you know, They Can't Take That Away From Me, or Fly Me to the Moon, or, you know, classic songs that I was able to make kind of new renditions of and invite some of my absolute favorite singers on the planet to accompany me on those tracks. So it was really a dream project musically. But yes, I think because there's no dialogue for the animators, it was helpful to have at least the tempo of scenes and whatnot kind of mapped out in a preliminary way with the music. So I started with that while we were doing the first storyboards already.
And, you know, like a lot of movies, you watch it, and if they have songs in it, they sort of overwhelm the scene. Mm-hmm. So what you hear is this, you know, very lush, big film. But in this one, they're a little bit at a distance, a little bit like you're listening to it on an old phonograph or radio, mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in terms of whether it's diegetic or non-diegetic, I think most of the time it was just supposed to kind of emotionally push it along without it being like a big dance number or anything.
Right,
like
right,
that.
Right.
So it was more just sort of guiding it. I don't know. The singers that I approached all have this wonderful way of emoting beautifully, even if they're singing quite softly. And they kind of, you know, say Emiliana Torrini, for instance, from Iceland, she has such a whisper quiet style, but it's so emotive. And so she doesn't really need like a big, you know, brassy track behind her or anything. She can kind of tug at all your heartstrings with just her voice and some space, you know. So space was the operative word for me, even in producing some of the backing tracks.
And space.
Yeah, exactly. Just keeping room kind of not only for the vocalist, but also for the audience, hopefully, while they're watching and listening, that they have space to even reflect on perhaps their own memories, similar memories from childhood. You know, the whole timing and balance of the film was kind of designed to be like that, not just assault you with tons of information all the time, which I'm very good at. As a scratch DJ, I could easily fill up every single sliver of time with a different noise and whatnot. So In a way, Space Cadet, both in visual design with Lillian and Corinne's design, and musically, my approach was just to try to score what they had visually built, which in some cases was minimal, you know, purposefully minimal, just so that the audience has that room to kind of like resonate with it more in a way, you know. It's funny. It's like I studied to be an elementary school teacher, and it comes back to this one lesson that I learned. I remember it was the day, actually, oddly enough, it was the day after Halloween. I had a first grade class. I was just, you know, at the end of my studies for it, and I was placed in a first grade class with a mentor teacher. And the kids were bouncing off the walls, all sugared up from all the tricks and treats that they had and brought to school. And I was trying to get their attention, trying to get them to settle down. And you know, it got to the point where I was turning the lights on and off. And I'm like, please, kids, settle down. We got to start class. And then my mentor teacher said, she's like, Eric, I'm going to show you something. And then she just basically went and sat, you know, by the story circle, you know, in the carpet. And then she just started whispering. She said, so, class, what we're going to do today is we're going to read a story about Halloween, and that's what I'm, you know. And it's funny because all of a sudden all the kids were just like shh, shh, and then someone was acting up and still wired, they were like, shut up, she's saying something, you know? And what she showed me was this idea that's like, oh, in order to quiet down, like I was doing it the wrong way, I was trying to get louder to get them to settle down, and she just got quieter, and then everybody leaned in, you know, and everyone was like trying to hear, and she, I saw her within 10 seconds focus the class in a way that I couldn't do like for 30 minutes prior to that. So I think as a film, this is hopefully, you know, kind of like that, maybe a little bit of a respite for the overstimulation.
No, yeah, there's a real calmness to it. And, you know, there are scary parts, sort of, when she's on
a couple. Yeah, we have a little bit of action and tension there, obviously. Yeah.
But what would you say is the age you're aiming for?
Our producer says 8 and up.
8 and up, okay.
But I mean, my kids have been we've been working on it since they were 4. Some like early versions of boards and things like that. I mean, as a story, I think there's a lot to relate to no matter what your age is, but it does deal with, you know, life cycles and
death, yeah,
generations and things like that. And so sometimes maybe it's a little emotional for very young children, but
right,
I don't know, I always think kids are more emotionally intelligent than we give them credit for, you know what I mean?
definitely.
And in a way, you know, I think this film, even though it deals with things like topics like cycles of generations and moving on from that, I think I hope that it serves more as like a comfort, you know, for people, you know, even if it's like, oh, dealing with loss in terms of even a pet or something, not necessarily a family member or whatnot. It could be just, you know, hopefully something that can comfort people.
And finally, let's talk about the robot.
Yes.
It's like right now AI is at the center of things, but in your film, you sort of have robotics and AI combined. So, and this robot has memory and can learn and has emotions. This is radio, but could you describe the look of the robot? To me, it was some combination of Lost in Space and maybe the Jetsons and things. I don't know.
Simplified. I mean, he's kind of got this brushed aluminum look. His head is designed after my wife's favorite food, which is a hamburger. So he's kind of got a hamburger shaped head.
Oh, yeah, like cheeseburger. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, but he's got this brushed aluminum look. I think, you know, like imagine a soap dispenser, some sort of like,
right, almost like a salt and pepper shaker. Like, yeah.
Yeah, he's not really the most high tech robot. In fact, he's the first generation of Guardian Bot that was released in this universe, which were.
But, and is it a he? Is it a he or a she? Because they don't speak.
They don't speak. I always thought of him as a he, but I guess that people could think of, you know, whatever they bring out of it.
I guess he puts on a bow tie. Maybe that's a
indication. Yeah, he does have a bow tie for his to kind of snazz up for the graduation ceremony. So, yeah.
And is he a person, sort of?
I think as a character, I always thought of him as a, you know, a parental or a guardian figure, maybe parent or grandparent that again is kind of getting on in age and actually possibly at the end, nearing the end of their
life cycle.
Maybe life cycle, but more almost like, okay, if you're a guardian bot and you're supposed to raise the child to their adult, like, so he's there, he's not just like fresh off the assembly line or something, so his memory disk is almost full and the batteries and all the things are starting to like creak and make different noises and things like that. So there's the story does deal with aging also, but in a light way, I think. Yeah.
And he exists on, what is it, Robotcha?
Yeah, that's his favorite drink.
But he sort of needs it to, like, for energy.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, he's dealing as Celeste, you know, moves into her own, you know, new adventure or new as a young adult. He's kind of left behind on the planet and trying to find new ways to keep going, despite his main operative was just to raise her. But now that she's gone, he's like trying to find, like, you know, what else he can contribute, and what, how to pass his time during the days, you know.
Well, altogether, it's a wonderful movie, and I think everyone should go out and see it. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
Kid Koala's animated feature Space Cadet is playing on November 5th at the Real Asian Film Festival in Toronto, with a theatrical release coming in the future. This is Daniel Garb of the Movies each Saturday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.